The 7th Annual African Cycling Championships kicks off today in Eritrea. Riders will come from across the continent, including South Africa, Algeria, Morocco, Egypt, and also Rwanda, a country where cycling has become more than just an athletic pursuit. 17 years after the genocide there, the sport has become popular among many young Rwandan men trying to forget painful memories of the past. Philip Gurevich recently profiled Rwanda's national bicycling team, called Team Rwanda, for The New Yorker, and we asked him why cycling has taken such strong hold there.
I had been visiting Rwanda for 15 years before I became aware that there was a national team or an organized bicycling scene. But what you realize the second you get to the country is how central the bicycle is to the local economy and to the life of rural Rwandans. And the bicycles, which are primarily Chinese and Indian, single-speed, old-fashioned, big black clunkers, get used to a point that by the time they're abandoned, they look like they've been melted. I mean, they really use them for carrying cargo, for carrying hundreds of tons of kilos. And Rwanda's a fairly high-altitude equatorial country. It's 5,000-6,000 feet above sea level and very, very hilly. So that it turns out that people who use a bike just as their daily transport are often in quite remarkable shape. And what really evolved was there had always been club cycling. It was a Belgian colony until 1960, and a little bit of that European cycling culture had rubbed off. And it's really only in the last decade or so that it's gotten itself more organized and knitted into the international cycling scene.
You know, you also write that for many of the young riders, cycling was a way of forgetting the past. And of course, this is a past that they weren't so much involved in as the generation before them, but they carry the burden of it. You write about one man named Adrian who lost much of his family during the genocide. And you quote his mom as saying that if he goes 3 days without riding his bike, the memories come flooding back to such an extent that he gets headaches. Did you find that biking was therapy for a lot of the riders?
Yes, I did. I mean, I wouldn't say that they're riding to forget the past because they can't. They're riding, in a sense, to put that memory further behind them. And for this particular group of, it is guys, these young guys who are on the team, they're all in their early 20s or so, which means that they were 4, 5, 6, 7 years old during the genocide, which means they have a vivid experience. And at the same time, they were neither responsible for it, not guilty of it. And so it's something that's always there for them, and yet they have had the opportunity to sort of think, well, what else could we be? And bicycling, it's physically just arduous on the body. And it often turns out that people who have an appetite for that are people for whom there's an element of displacement, that the bike gives suffering a purpose.
On that note, you write about the American coach of this team who's living in Rwanda, noting that his bicyclists don't initially have the strategic thinking he needs them to have to bicycle, but they have so much raw power and ability to endure pain that he really feels like he has a lot of good raw material to work with.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things that is striking on this team, most of these kids are not particularly from a privileged background, even within Rwanda. I mean, they don't have education. Most of them started work as bicycle taximen or bicycle cargo people. One of the guys I write about a lot, Gasore Hategeka, was a street kid.
In fact, would you talk a bit about how Gasore got onto the team? Because this was a person who initially had jobs that had him on, as you call them, Flintstonian scooters, somebody who had the crudest of bikes and eventually saved money to buy his own.
You see fewer of them these days in Rwanda because they're not allowed on the roads anymore for road safety, but in Rwanda they have wooden bikes. The wheels themselves are made of wood, and you used to see these kids coming down a hill with, you know, 150 kilos of bananas balanced on one of these things and flying along at 40, 50 kilometers an hour with an ecstatic grin on their face that you also thought might be the last expression they ever had. It did not look safe. And that's how Gasore got started, probably just pushing one of these things. He did that. He worked in the potato markets in the Northwest, and he disciplined himself and saved the little pennies, the nickels that he was being paid. And ultimately, it took him till he was in his late teens, but he was able to buy a used bicycle and became a taxi man. And as he was then riding mostly cargo on the back of the bike, he would start to race against the members of the team who would go by during their training runs. And in this way, he sort of got noticed because he had tremendous power. And so you take a guy like that, and to go back to your earlier question about the difficulty of combining the raw power with strategic thinking, just getting somebody to do two things at once, Jock Boyer, the coach, would often say, just getting somebody to not stop pedaling when they drank water, and to drink water so they don't get dehydrated, and to eat food while they're riding, and to keep pedaling through that. It sounds like not much, but it's all of that has to be learned from scratch.
Did you come across any members of the Rwandan team where, say, one person's father had been Hutu and one had been Tutsi, and maybe they had to find a way to get past that in order to be teammates?
For the most part, it's not something that they're talking about all day long with the public. But one of the things that's interesting, when I would talk to Gasori about his very difficult childhood growing up as an orphan, at first he didn't tell me how his father had died. And then I learned that his father died in the war, and he didn't. He said, yeah, of course. And he said, but, you know, that history belongs to the old people. That's not, it was sort of saying, I don't want to be defined by all this history that happened before I got around to getting a chance to define myself.
Philip, in your article, you have these great, funny descriptions of how the Rwandan cyclists' eyes are opened when they begin to travel around the world to race. They're seeing big cities for the first time. They encounter air conditioning for the first time. They find it very funny that Americans live with pets. After they encountered all of that, did you find that it was hard for them to return to Rwanda and live there?
No. In fact, what I was trying to convey to some extent is how we look exotic to them. One of the scenes that I described is this one rider, Rafiki, in America, looking at how people live and saying, as he's driving through the American West, why people live so spread out from each other. It's totally bizarre. You have people who have a house, and then it's 20 miles till the next house. And then each of these people has this redundant amount of stuff instead of living near other people so that you can share things, as we do in Rwanda, where we live near each other for a kind of physical and collective security. And I don't mean security from dangerous people, but, you know, you can borrow things, you have company. Why? What's these Americans are strange, he thought, living alone in the bush. And they would rather go home and be a sort of successful and exemplary person in their community than imagine themselves at large in the world as some Rwandan who managed to just barely make it in America. On the other hand, you have Adrian, who is the star at this point. He actually has qualified in mountain biking for the 2012 Olympics in London. And he was hired about a year and a half ago to ride for the biggest professional team in South Africa. So he now lives in Johannesburg in South Africa. And he feels that as long as he's really pursuing his professional bicycling trajectory, it's better for him not to be at home. He wants to be insulated from all the distractions and pressures and demands of home and family, of his survivor relatives, of the needs that they have, of the weight of the past that's always there when he's riding in Rwanda. He feels this liberation, in a sense, to pursue his excellence as an athlete by leaving the country. And that's a tension that I think reflects also many of these deeper social things that they're struggling with as they try to emerge.
That's Philip Gurevich, who writes for The New Yorker. He's been speaking with us about his story on the Rwandan national bicycling team, which is competing this week in the African Cycling Championships. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.